And now, Stein Online presents Mark Stein on the Town.
Happy Australia Day. I always wish I were down under on Australia Day because it's the height of summer there, whereas here, in my chilly corner of New Hampshire, it's down under only in the sense that the temperature is 40 below. So I thought we'd warm things up with a little music from the Lucky Country. We might as well get a certain song out of the way right up front. What could be more Australian than this?
Le vent du passé me murmure un conte effacé, éveillant mes amours fanés, valse du souvenir, mélodie des désirs oubliés. Quand vous dansiez, Mathilda, valse Mathilda, valse Mathilda, charmant fantôme de mes jours fleuris, tourbillon parfumé, en valsant vous étiez si jolie. Vous dansiez, Mathilda, pour moi.
That's the great French actor Yves Montand singing Waltzing Mathilda en français, in French. I heard Barry Humphreys, Dame Edna's friend, play that on the radio the other day, but he played Monsieur Montand with the full orchestra. And to me, it's Monsieur Montand avec seulement la guitare qui est the best version. And of course, you might as well hear, if you're non-Australian, you might as well hear Waltzing Mathilda in a language you don't understand, because to non-Australians, the original English is completely incomprehensible anyway. Banjo Paterson's great song is about travelling on foot. That's waltzing. With your belongings in a swag bag. That's a Mathilda. So who'll come a-waltzing Mathilda with me? Who'll come walking through the bush with your swag on your back? Yves Montand in French turns Waltzing Mathilda into a song about waltzing a girl called Mathilda. And when you think about it, Mathilde is a far more common name in French than it is in English. I knew briefly, many years ago, and all too briefly, a lovely Mathilde from the Haute Alpes. I seem to be wandering a bit far afield here. Waltzing Mathilda became an unofficial national anthem of Australia. And then in the 1980s, another unofficial national anthem came along. Here am I on the radio way back when, in those glory days, talking to Greg Hamm from the band Men at Work.
The monster track is Down Under, and I wondered if it's become a kind of Australian anthem. It looks as if it may well be hung around your neck like My Way with Frank Sinatra or something like that, you know, where it is just so big. And, you know, it is, and put Vegemite sandwiches on the map. Is it in fact something that you are already getting perhaps a little sick of playing, or do you still enjoy it?
I don't get sick of playing it. We still enjoy, I mean, it's a good song, that's why it's been such a success. And I mean, we've played it really since the start of the band, since the start of the band. And I guess we'll have to play it forever, you know? I mean, it is one of those things, and But I think that the biggest problem it's caused for us, if there has caused any problems, is that it's some people are looking at it as being, well, this is what Men at Work are about, when it really is just one of our songs. And there's people that have written us off as being sort of Aussie bonzos, you know, and idiots that do songs about drinking beer. And that's not really, I mean, the song is tongue-in-cheek, but people tend to read into things what they want to.
We'll be right back. a fight at Cumbie, on a hippie trailhead full of zombies. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. She took me in and gave me breakfast. And she said, do you come from a land down under? Where women go and men plunder? Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover. I said, do you speak my language? He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich. And he said, I come from a land down under, where we don't know and mention her.
If I get things right, you're flautist, saxophonist, keyboards man, and vocalist, I think.
Yeah, that's right. I do all of those things and just sort of generally loon around on the stage and I think I actually play a bit of harmonica in one song.
So you're the all-purpose member.
That's right, yeah. Jack of all trades, master of none. It's like the utility player, you know, thrown in on a half-forward flank and basically the bits that they don't want to do.
Well, as you can tell, I wasn't a great interviewer at the time. And I think there's some voice going backwards from some entirely different interview behind us there. But I think I pressed a button and sorted that out after a couple of minutes. But when Greg Hamm says he does the stuff that the rest of the band didn't want to do, that includes that distinctive, unforgettable flute riff on Down Under. That was number one in Australia on Australia Day. But it was also number one around the planet. In fact, Men at Work are the only Australian band to have topped the UK and US charts simultaneously. And ever since, Down Under has been a kind of musical shorthand for contemporary Australia. It was used on the Kangaroo Jack soundtrack and the trailer for Finding Nemo. In part because of that famous couplet that I referenced to Greg. I said, do you speak my language? He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich, which is a truly atrocious rhyme, but for a while did wonders for Vegemite sales in the Northern Hemisphere. I can't speak for Aussies, but I think what the rest of the world likes about the song is that it captures Australians as most of us first encounter them, the backpacking globetrotter in a bar in Earl's Court or Dublin or Hong Kong or Vancouver or Delhi or a thousand other spots. I did my share of travelling in my youth. And like a lot of folks, I was always glad to find myself on a bar stool next to an Australian. Wherever you're from, they never seem that foreign to you, if you know what I mean. And if you don't, well, give it a go next time you're in a bar on the other side of the planet. And maybe you'll get lucky and it'll be an Aussie sitting on the stool next to you. What was it Greg Hamm said about the song? I guess we'll have to play it forever. Well, when you're a young rock and roll star, forever stretches off into the shimmering haze like the Australian bush. And Greg Hamm's forever turned out to be a lot shorter than he might have expected. I was very shocked just before my 2012 Oz tour to hear that Greg had been found dead at his home in Melbourne. He was just 58. As I said, this isn't a great interview. We had much livelier conversation in the pub afterwards, but it captures a phenomenally successful Australian act at the height of their global celebrity. And listen to the clumsy way I ask him about the quote-unquote music business and his carefree profession of zero interest in the business. And hold that thought.
Well, we know you obviously from Men at Work. Now, I don't know what the five of you were doing before that, but I wondered how you first got interested in music as a business.
Well, I don't think I've ever been interested in music as a business. But you have to deal with it as a business more and more, it seems. In fact, I knew nothing about music as a business before. But, yeah, my own particular kind of background to this was I didn't really play any music until a couple of years of university, and I was doing law and some strange subjects, I don't know why. But basically I left that and started just trying to learn. I was on the dole and had plenty of time on my hands, and I lived in a house where a girl had a flute. Mm. And she never played it, but she kept it scrupulously clean, and I played it and never cleaned it at all. So eventually she quite rightly threw a fit because there were rather large looking pieces of sort of supper sitting on the mouthpiece of the flute, and I had to go out and get one of my own, you know, and it kind of, I went from there. I basically taught myself.
So you're saying that you never really showed much interest in playing music until you were 20 or so?
Yeah, I guess I would have been 21, I think, by the time I really actually bought instruments and started working on it. But I always liked it, but it was one of those things. I had that feeling in the back of my head that, and it's a conditioned thing that people come across, is that unless you've learnt music since you're 5 years old, forget it, you know, because you can't compete. And yet I ended up going to a music college where I was in. I went there with people that had been learning it from when they were 5 years old, and I realised that for me, there were plenty of advantages in doing it as an adult, you know, because I mean, I learnt what I wanted to, and I could improvise, you know, from sitting in my bedroom late at night, sort of just doodling around, whereas these people that had done since they were five were totally sort of stuck in a classical thing and couldn't improvise and really missed a lot of enjoyment of music, I think.
Do you think that still holds true today? I mean, I don't know whether the girl you were with was a classical flautist, but perhaps makes you a little less adventurous.
It can do. It comes down to teaching, because, or the individual teacher, because I did some teaching as well while I was at music college, which was like at one stage I had the band and I was teaching, and I was also going to music college, and that was like the busiest time in my life. But I found as a teacher that you could still. There was a way of approaching classical music that that left avenues open for free expression as well. I think it comes down again to people. She does electric computer. Honey, better take her home. She is a keyboard operator. Really like a saxophone. She does electric computer. Honey, better take her home. Honey, better take her home. Honey, better take her home.
I still think the UK takes a fairly patronising attitude towards Australian music.
No. Well, sometimes.
Right. Well, I mean, I think as you said, the UK was about the last country in the world to get wise to you. Now the music business over there is, I think, possibly a little rougher in its own way than it is here. I mean, you started on that pub and club circuit in Melbourne and Sydney, and I think that's probably the equivalent to the way music hall here was about 100 years ago. Mm. In that, if you're no good, you really bomb badly.
Yeah, that does tend to happen. I don't know that it's any tougher than in England. I think in some ways it's I think kids have got perhaps a bit more money in Australia to go out, so that for a small population, and it's such a tradition with people, you know, that's what you do on a Saturday night or Friday night, or some people any night of the week, is you go out to a rock and roll gig, you know, and usually that's at your local pub. But there's a lot of people do go out to see these shows, so a small population can keep a large number of bands more or less in work. But there are a lot of bands, so I think the competitiveness comes between, not between the bands themselves, but to be successful, consistently successful, you have to be very good, and you have to prove yourself in a live sense, because you know, that's what the punters really want to see. They want to see you get up there and sweat and give it all. You know.
Experience based, kicking stones and cans. Experience based, cigarettes and hands. It's not too late, hear it in the wind. It's not too late, feel passion creeping in. Intoxication, familiar smells of the hotel. Infatuation of knowing who you are. You and I arrow through my heart, catch a star.
So how did you meet the four other guys in the band then? Was that after music college?
No, that was, I met everybody, well, actually bar say Ron and John, I'd met them well before I went to college. I met Colin before I just left school. Mm-hmm. He just left school, and he was kind of doing kind of gigs in coffee shops and things by himself, just playing acoustic guitar, and I heard him play, and I thought it was great. I mean, he was one of the people that made me interested in music. You know, I heard somebody playing something around, and I thought, it would be great to be able to do that, you know. But at that stage, I wasn't playing anything. And Jerry, I'd met Colin through people that I went to school with, that he went to school with, but we never went to school together. And Jerry was the same, you know. He knew people that I'd gone to school with, and I played with bands with them, and eventually I ended up playing with him in a band, and he played with Colin in a band. It was like all these, and then Colin played with Ron, John played with Jerry, and it was like all these little connections were made. Eventually they sort of collated or whatever, and the band and everybody was available at the same time. There's a lot of luck and coincidence involved, you know, but we're all... I just left a band. Jerry had, Colin and Ron were kind of looking to get a band together, so it all gelled at the right time.
It all came about. Mm. Now, Who Can It Be Now was what I might call your first international success, and it was a number one in America and one of the biggest hits of last year. Had it been a big success in Australia, and if so, were you a little surprised when it then was a hit in the US?
It was a big success. Well, it was our first success in Australia, really. I mean, it was the first single we released. We did it. We recorded it before we did the album, more or less as a test run for CBS and to work with this producer. And, it got to number one in Australia, which for the first single was quite a... it can't do much better than that. So it was... we thought, well, that's great. You know, and we liked the song, and we liked the way it had been recorded, and we felt good about the actual recording and everything, you know.
And this is Greg starting the record, because at the session, the producer decided he wanted to open the track with a saxophone. So Greg picked up the sax, just another one of those instruments he taught himself to play in his 20s.
Mm-hmm.
and it did get quite a bit of success in Europe very early on, before the States. And so it wasn't so much of a surprise. It was gratifying to have it get there, you know, because it faced some fairly stiff competition, and just resistance generally from a place that when radios don't know an artist, then it takes a bit to sort of to push it. And there were times when it could have died, and there were the times when I guess our management and the record company did their gig, you know, and kept it afloat.
That I can see, it's just my fantasy.
Everyone liked Men at Work in the 80s, except some of the big shot rock critics, who could be a little sniffy, as I pointed out to Greg.
I think that we go over well to the audiences. I think we did when we were here last time. It certainly hasn't, success hasn't made any difference to some of the reviews that we've got in certain rock presses, but I don't think that will ever change.
I think we'll go a bit more ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, I don't think they can get much more ridiculous, you know, or else it'd be actionable.
Actionable, mate. I don't even think I knew what that word meant back then. I'd yet to be sued for anything. Happy the man who knows not the meaning of the word actionable. But Greg Hamm knew, because as he'd mentioned earlier, before he picked up his flatmate's flute, he had been a law student. And a quarter century after Down Under was number one around the world, a man who said he had no interest in the business of music was to find out that his most famous musical contribution was itself actionable.
Traveling in a freighter combi on a hippie trailhead full of zombies.
In 1932, an Australian school teacher wrote a children's song for a Girl Guides competition. It was called Kookaburra Sits in the Old Gum Tree.
Kookaburra sits in the old gum tree. Merry, merry king of the bush is he. Kookaburra love, Kookaburra gay, your life must be.
Can you hear Down Under in that? That's Greg Hamm. This is Kookaburra again.
Kookaburra sits in the old gum tree. Merry, merry king of the bush is he. Kookaburra love, Kookaburra gay, your life must be.
That song was known to girl guides in Australia and various other parts of the British Commonwealth, but the teacher, Marion Sinclair, didn't enforce her copyright, and those who knew the song assumed it was an old traditional folk tune. Miss Sinclair died in 1988, and a fellow called Norman Lurie of Larrikin Music acquired her copyright, I think for around $6,000. And in the early 21st century, he filed suit for between 40 and 60% of the royalties of Down Under. The court eventually awarded him 5%. I've advised on musical copyright suits hither and yon from time to time, and I think I could have won this one for Men at Work. And I wish they'd asked me, because they did not deserve to lose this case. They lost again on appeal and were turned down by the Australian High Court, which, as you know, has become a somewhat mercurial body. But I think it was a very weak suit that would not have prevailed in London or New York or elsewhere. In the summer of 2012, to coincide with the Olympic Games in Britain, the co-author of the song, Colin Hay, released a new version of Down Under.
Traveling in a fried out combi on a hippie trail head full of zombies. I met a strange lady, she made me nervous. Breakfast. She said, do you come from a land down under? Women glow and men plunder. Can't you hear the thunder? You better run, you better take cover.
That was July of 2012. In April of that year, Greg Hamm was found dead at his home in Carlton North. He was 58. I don't believe there's ever been an official cause of death, but it's generally believed to be depression and a fatal heart attack brought on by the stress of the case. And by the fact that, as he put it, quote, that's how I'm going to be remembered for copying something. Very unfair. I think of Greg Hamm at that peak of worldwide rock and roll hit-making stardom in the 80s, and it upsets me to think of him dead in his front room for a couple of days before anybody found him. We've played the hit version of the song and that 2012 Colin Hay remake. Here's Greg and Men at Work and the way they first played Down Under. Thank you. An Australian anthem. Rest in peace, Greg Hamm. In 1978, a big Hollywood movie about Vietnam was released, The Deer Hunter. And it had an instrumental piece of music in it that became a worldwide hit. It was played on screen and on record by another musician from Melbourne, the classical guitarist John Williams. Thank you. Well, if you associate that with Robert De Niro and Christopher Walken, you'll know it as the theme from The Deer Hunter. If you've heard it with the lyrics Cleo Lane wrote to the tune, you'll know it as He Was Beautiful. That's Cleo accompanied by John Williams on guitar. But it's actually called not the theme from The Deer Hunter or He Was Beautiful. It's actually called Cavatina. And Stanley Myers wrote the music. And then John Williams asked him to expand it. And The Deer Hunter turned out, in fact, to be the second film it was used in. It first appeared in a rather groovy film with David Hemmings and lovely Samantha Eggar, called The Walking Stick in 1970. I've had the pleasure of hosting John Williams on my show a few times, including when he's taken out his guitar and played live, which we'll maybe dig out for one of our best of the live music specials, because we're all about the gramophone records today, no live music. Graham Wade, the guitarologist, if that's a word, he's written books on Segovia and those sort of chaps. Graham Wade has called John Williams, quote, the most technically accomplished guitarist the world has seen. But he was also, in the 70s and 80s, perhaps the most commercially successful classical guitarist on the planet. He formed a fusion band, or if you prefer, a crossover group, half classical, half progressive rock, called Sky. John Williams from Melbourne and Kevin Peake from Adelaide got together with a couple of English fellows, and they had a band name Logo for Sky, just like the Rolling Stones did in the 70s. And Sky had big hit albums, top five, number one type albums. So here's me talking to a couple of members of that Anglo-Aussie agglomeration, John Williams and the late Steve Gray. The new single by Sky, which is called Masquerade, and that is originally by Khatchaturi Khan, I think is about is the original Armenian pronunciation, I think.
That's the best I've ever heard it.
Is it?
Yeah.
I got that from the BBC pronunciation unit, actually. They assured me on there. But I have with me John Williams and Steve Gray from Sky, the newest member of the band and one of the founder members. The album's a mixture of well-known classical tunes like Ride of the Valkyrie and also things that aren't
so... That's not a tune.
It's not a tune.
We refuse to call it a tune.
We're not even sure if it's music.
You've quite staggered me there. What you said about Wagner. I mean, there's a lot of people who don't like Wagner, but they don't go out and record his music on albums then. What is it that that made you pick... those fairly well-known ones and then something not so well-known? Was it a calculated balance, or was it just all your particular faves that you fancied doing?
It wasn't a calculated balance, no. I think every tune or every piece, or in Wagner's case, every 5 minutes of music has got...
Music? Come on!
well, in fact, we could come to that point. The Wagner pieces, everything has to have its own merit and its own reason, and that's really the only reason. The Wagner piece is there because it's a great piece of theatre. I really don't regard it as music at all. I mean, if you look at the score and you analyse, you can arguably say that Wagner was a charlatan or that he was a great composer still. But Valkyrie, I find amusing. It makes me fall around laughing that someone could sit down and actually write that piece of... write that work.
Wagner is a composer who has great moments but awful quarter hours or something, I think I once heard somebody say.
Yeah.
You've managed to restrict him to about 5 minutes, so perhaps he falls somewhere in the middle. But was that something you wanted to do as more as a theatrical thing? Because
again,
it was such an outrageous trick.
It is outrageous. I mean, we did one mix of it when we mixed it, because you can record things and get all the notes down, and then you can really start creating in the mix the feeling that you want. And we did one mix of it, which was perfect, and we could play it and say, well, you could put that next to, say, the LSO, and the cohesion of it would be the same. And that, I felt, well, I didn't feel, but John felt, and I came to agree with him, was wrong. What we were doing was saying, hey, look at us, five of us can make the same noise as 108 members of the orchestra that Wagner required and do the same trick, so you know we're obviously better. So we remixed it in a way where the warts come out, you know, because it's full of warts really, and holes and flip-flops and all sorts of things.
John, you look baffled there. But
no, I was just going to add, yes. It was very much, I remember when Steve was doing the arrangement as well, we had at the back of our minds the sort of thing that Liszt paraphrases a lot of the operatic, not just Wagner but all the other 19th century Italian operatic composers as well. That's very important, I think, bearing in mind generally our records and a number like this, is that we're thinking also in terms of the stage show. When we're on stage for two and a half hours, and the dramatic, the theatrical part is important. Not that we've got all those props and things, but the actual sort of lighting and the way we, have different parts and different instruments and the way it balances in the programme. So, you know, just doing this piece of quote music is an important part of that, and it's got all our imagination going. We will do it. We're not doing it on this tour, but we will be doing it, you know, towards the end of the year, preparing it. So that sort of sound of sort of five of us hammering away at a whole lot of notes, which normally an orchestra of 110 does, was the appeal, you know, not to try and imitate the orchestra, but sort of to be even more outrageous than the original, in a sense.
Yes, and possibly Wagner is sitting either up in heaven or down in hell at the moment, thinking, the guys at least have got a sense of humour or something about
it. Maybe. Some people don't like it. I mean, we have been told that it's the one track that doesn't work on the album for some people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's fair enough. I think it's outrageous enough to provoke either like or dislike, and that's good. That's theatrical as well, really. The idea for this album, in fact, was mooted before I joined the band. And when I joined the band, said we'll be doing Sky 3 in January 1981, and Sky 4, which will be mostly, if not all, non-original stuff.
I noticed that you've done an awful lot of the arrangements for this album.
Well, the arrangements in this sense are really just the man who sits down at 3 o'clock with a bottle of wine and writes out the dots. You know, in fact, we could just have easily put on the back of the sleeve and. Perhaps we should have done Arranged by Sky, because, for instance, I think maybe Herbie's contribution isn't as publicly as acknowledged as we would have liked it to have been.
And that's really all there is to arranging, sitting down with a bottle of wine at 3 a.m. Because I was about to congratulate you on a superb arrangement of Skylark, but you make it sound as if, you know, it's the sort of thing anyone could have done now.
Well, perhaps it is. If you've got, I'm going to embarrass John, but if you've got John... to play the tune, it is, I'm afraid, going to sound good. You could give John the washing list and he'd play it and it would sound good.
That's a paraphrase of Rossini.
Well, I'm embarrassed, I'm going to interrupt here because I think the arranging thing is that there are in one or two numbers the actual arrangement and how it's done and the dots on the paper are important. It's just that it shouldn't be assumed that in every case. The only importance is who's credited with arranging. I mean, sometimes the dots, like as in March the Scaffold or Ride of the Valkyrie, you know, how to sort of lay the thing out, the idea in the head of how to do it, it is important because it ends up as 95% what we do in the studio.
I do like that arrangement of Skylark by Hoagie Carmichael, and Hoagie Carmichael died just after Christmas this year.
That's right.
And I would have assumed this, you would have chosen to record this track sometime beforehand, before
That's
his
right.
death.
Yes.
Thank you.
On one of those shows of mine where he played live, John Williams told me that when he does a song, he learns how to play the tune from the score, but he learns how to interpret the tune from the lyric. And you can certainly hear that there. Hoagie Carmichael's music for Skylark, but Johnny Mercer's words are implicitly present in John's guitar. I'll have John Williams give a further demonstration of that point on one of our live music anthologies some ways down the road.
Any ideas for Sky 5 yet, or is it going to be?
Yeah, I think so. We might be breaching a few confidences. I think we feel maybe we're ready now for a live double album, which would contain quite a lot of new material, because I don't really want to get into the Sky's greatest hits idea too much with a live one. We do an awful lot of stuff actually from earlier albums in a way which has changed quite a bit since they were originally recorded. So I think maybe we're ready for a live one. The problem is really where, because we might go to Japan in the autumn, and I think it would be cheating British and Australian people, which are our home grounds, to record in Japan. You know, it's like, oh, we got so big time, we're going out the Budokan, we don't need you anymore.
Well, maybe the Commonwealth Games, because an appropriate time, because you're out there at the same time, aren't you?
Yeah, we were going to do that, but Australia, which has got one of the worst strike records in the world, I might add, can't get the hall built in time, so that's out the window. But I think that's the thinking. Things might change. I mean, if we see you in a year's time with Sky 5, which was recorded down in Abbey Road, I mean, don't blame me.
No, okay, I won't hold you to that, but it does sound a nice idea, a live album.
Anyway, it's because it's Queensland. It's not really Australia, you know.
That's Saint-Saëns, The Swan, from the Carnival of the Animals, played Sky style. And in the end, despite their concerns, they didn't betray their Anglo-Aussie base for the live album. That's from the Sky 5 live album, recorded not in Japan, but variously at concert halls in Melbourne, Perth, Adelaide and Sydney, although no Queensland note. If you heard what John was saying there. So let's forget about the music entirely, and let me tip my hat to a great Australian disc jockey, my favourite Australian disc jockey. Born in New South Wales, he got his first job in Tasmania at 7LA and then moved to 3KZ in Melbourne. And then he got on a boat to London and put a rocket up the BBC.
I guess that's about the picture for this week. Hope you've enjoyed the records, but don't forget, looking forward to your company next Thursday night round the 5 Time spot, when we'll have ourselves one or two discs playing in records around 5. On Thursday, all right? Right. Good night.
That's Alan Fluff Freeman, lovely man, very kind to me and full of good advice. He had that colonial cringe thing when he got off the boat in England in the late 1950s, and he was a bit insecure and uncertain in his speech patterns. And so he had a nervous tic of seeking affirmation for what he'd just said by ending sentences with the word, right, with that upward Aussie inflection. And the snooty English chaps at the BBC and elsewhere noticed it. So he decided to make it a catchphrase. All right, right, stay bright, as you heard just there in 1960 on the BBC Light programme. And he kept it up all the way to the end, through generations of pop and rock music, along with the very same theme tune, terrific theme tune, and an even better arrangement of that theme tune. And we'll get Barbara Moore, who wrote that great arrangement. We're going to get Barbara Moore on the show one day because she's a fantastic arranger, and that's a killer arrangement. But Alan kept up all that, all right, right, stay bright. He kept all that up all the way to the end, along with that same theme tune and the same introduction. Greetings, pop pickers. Here he is, a musical generation later.
The number one's on 1FM, right? Not off. And the Pick of the Pops top 20 for the year 1982. At number 20, if you can't stand the heat, Bucks Fizz, Santa Claus and the Christmas Tree there at number 19 with Sing Along Santa. At number 18, Buffalo Girls from Malcolm McLaren and the world-famous Supreme Team. And at number 17... Get this straight from Crevin Rowland and Dexy's Midnight Runners at number 16. We had Ultravox and Him at 15. Friends from Shalimar, Dionne Warwick at number 14. All the Love in the World and down at number 13. It was Wham! And Young Guns go for it at number 12. Mirror Man from the Human League. Cliff Richard at number 11. And the one called Little Town. Down at number 10, Beat Surrender and Shopping from the Jam. At number 9, Truly from Mr. Lionel Richie. Modern Romance at number 8, Best Years of Our Lives. New at number 7, A Winter's Tale from David Essex. Phil Collins at number 6, You Can't Hurry Love. At number 5, Our House from Madness. And down at number 4 was... Culture Club and Time, Clock of the Heart in the top 3, Peace on Earth and Little Drummer Boy, David Bowie and Bing Crosby. Up at number 2, The Shaky EP and A Little Blue Christmas, right? And at number 1 in 1982 in Pick of the Pops, we had Renee, we had Renato and the one called Save Your Love. And that was Pick of the Pops. All right. Right, stay bright.
As the BBC's Paul Gambaccini said, Alan Freeman made the tabulation of mere record sales thrilling, thrilling. I far preferred his chart countdowns to Casey Kasem's. All right, stay bright. We will try to do that. We've been a bit Victoria-centric on this Australia Day special. My guests, Greg Hamm, John Williams, were from Melbourne. So let's close with a final Victorian bit of music. The last time I was in Melbourne, I went along to Her Majesty's Theatre to see a matinee of Georgie Girl, the Seekers musical, and I had a lovely time with all those marvellous Seekers hits, except I didn't really feel the show got the full juice out of this one. And as the years go by, this record touches me in ever more subtle and ambivalent ways. It makes me happy and sad, young and old, all at the same time. A child's song that's very affecting for grown-ups as the years slip by. Of course, it's Athol, Keith, Bruce, and the great Judith Durham.
Train whistle blowing makes a sleepy noise. Underneath their blankets go all the girls and boys. Rockin', rollin', ridin' out along the bay. All by
The Seekers, all bound for Morningtown, many miles away. Happy Australia Day. We'll do it again next year. G'day.